Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated February 15th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's lead article on the front page above the fold, Alofs Could Land in Durham and Raleigh, by Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Durham. The developers of two hotel projects in downtown Raleigh and Durham, and another in Raleigh. Let's start that over. The developers of two hotel projects in downtown Durham and another near downtown Raleigh are close to securing a commitment from the parent company of Alofs Hotels to place the Urban Influence brand on their buildings. Developers of the ATC East Hotel project, planned adjacent to the Durham Performing Arts Center, and the Bellevue building in Raleigh that's planned across from NC State University's Bell Tower on Hillsborough Street, are vying to finalize a deal with Starwood Hotels and Resorts Worldwide, according to sources close to each of the projects. Starwood opened the Alof Chapel Hill Hotel in 2010, its first in the region since launching the brand in 2008, and was working with local hotel developers to build at least two others in the region when the financial meltdown forced projects to be shelved. A hotel developer from Charlotte intends to open another Alofs hotel near Raleigh-Durham International Airport in 2014, but construction has yet to begin. Mark Sherburn, general manager of Alofs Chapel Hill, says he has no insider knowledge of Starwood's plans in the region, but he says he has been hearing talk about more Alofs properties coming through the pipeline. There have been discussions about others going into the Triangle area, including one near downtown Raleigh next to NC State's campus, as well as in downtown Durham, Sherburn says. Alofs is a new and upcoming brand that seems to be spreading quickly. It's very non-traditional in its look and feel, and people are gravitating towards it. In Durham, the owners of the American Tobacco campus have teamed up with Davidson and Jones Hotel Corporation of Raleigh to put together a plan for a six-story hotel and apartment complex that would wrap around the south and west sides of the Deepak building and its adjacent parking deck. The group has hired Chapel Hill architect Phil Sozak, who led the design of the Deepak, to also lead the design of the ATC hotel and apartment buildings. They've not given me permission to release any renderings yet, but I am working on the project, Sozak confirms. Michael Goodman, Vice President of Real Estate for Capital Broadcasting Company, which developed and owns most of American Tobacco Campus, in an email statement said that they are still in due diligence and that he couldn't talk details. Innovation was the watchword when the revival of the American Tobacco Campus began, and it remains our guiding principle, Goodman wrote. We are in due diligence on projects that would enhance the campus's reputation for customer satisfaction, stay true to our mission of innovation in creating a complete customer experience, and serve the greater Durham and Triangle communities. In Raleigh, a group of local investors has created a partnership called Bellevue Partners for the sole purpose of developing a 130-room hotel with 10,000 square feet of street-level retail space on land currently owned by NC State University's endowment fund. The university in 2011 selected the Bellevue Partners team, which includes the Washington, D.C.-based development firm, the Bernstein Companies, to develop a commercial-use building across from the Bell Tower on Hillsborough Street. Mark Andrews, with Bellevue Partners, says the property has been successfully rezoned, and he expects that the final paperwork for the hotel brand will be done in about 60 days. We've not signed anything yet, he says, while also declining to identify which hotel flag they are pursuing. Andrew says they hope they'll be able to begin construction in the first half of 2014. Still on the front page, Biogen's miracle drugs. Patients, doctors credit Avonix, Tysabri for saving lives. By Lauren K. Onisorge. from the RTP. In a room you'll probably never see, giant metal vats hold the makings of two medicines, Avonex and Tysabri, that generate billions of dollars for pharmaceutical giant Biogen IDEC. But to patients taking the drugs, those concoctions are not about dollar signs, nor the jobs the manufacturing center creates in RTP. They're about maintaining independence and hope. Take Kathy McIntosh, for example, a woman with a smile who is more than happy to share her story. When they knew I was talking to you, they said, "Oh, no, someone gave her a microphone," she laughs. If you look at McIntosh, there's no way you could know about the Avonex syringe she injects in her leg every week. No way you could know how she feels watching friends struggle while her disease is under control. No way you could know about that time more than 10 years ago when a doctor first told her she had multiple sclerosis. Her immune system, for reasons they have still not been determined, had turned on her nervous system. It's a chronic condition that causes blindness, impaired ambulatory function, debilitating dizziness, numbness, and even a loss of independence. McIntosh's right side endured periods of numbness for years, a heavy feeling in her arm. Her vision blurred, and no one had any answers. To tell you that you have MS, they really have to tell you what it's not, she explains, detailing the MRI scans and the spinal tap, all looking for evidence of the damage caused by the nerves to the nerves by her autoimmune disease. They say, "Well, the good news is you don't have a brain tumor," and you're like, "Was I supposed to have a brain tumor?" Eventually, they said the words, "Multiple sclerosis." "I was just happy to have answers," she remembers. And now there's hope and help. Dr. Mitchell Friedman of Raleigh Neurology Associates remembers that few options were available when he started treating patients for MS in 1978. "Patients died," he says. "Now, to die from MS is extremely rare. Patients that require nursing homes, that's substantially diminished, but it's certainly not zero." Early after her diagnosis, McIntosh tried to get long-term care insurance. "They don't let you get it if you have MS," she says, and that denial triggered a restlessness, the kind of in-the-back-of-your-mind fear that couldn't be quelled. She decided to fight the uncertainty by getting involved in organizations that have information about the disease and help those with it cope. At her first MS Society event, McIntosh made a new friend, a woman whose MS had blinded her and forced her to walk with a seeing eye dog. "It's scary," she says, pausing. "It can be scary." Scarier still is seeing friends who were healthy at the last MS walk, greeting her the next time with the help of a scooter to get around. "I am lucky," she says, saying that's why she walks at National MS Society events, because she can. McIntosh's MS technically is in remission. The disease is often a relapse-remitting one, a designation that means it starts and stops. McIntosh has been on Avonex for 10 years, and it's working. She is fortunate. The treatments don't work for everyone. "That's why it's so great that there are other options out there," she notes. When she realized Avonex worked, she stopped being afraid. Fear shifted to hope. For the record, Avonex has been shown to prevent a relapse in 37% of users. Tysabri works better, with a 68% relapse prevention rate, but it carries more risk. "The medicines have made a difference in prognosis," Friedman says. "We have options and choices that we never had 20 years ago. But the treatment is expensive. In the pharmaceutical industry, prices charged vary according to policies of pharmacies, insurance plans, and physician practices. But the industry offers what's known as the wholesaler acquisition cost, or WAC, for one administration pack of Avonex, four doses, the WAC is $3,914. Avonex is dosed weekly, working out to a weekly cost right at $1,000. For a 300-milligram dose of Tysabri, the cost is $4,035. Because the drug is administered once a month, that works out to a cost of, again, right at $1,000 per week. Combined, the two MS drugs represent the bulk of Biogen IDEC's revenue, which totaled $5.48 billion in 2012. Of that, Evonex contributed $2.9 billion, and Tysabri brought in $1.1 billion. The Cambridge, Massachusetts-based company booked net income of $1.38 billion in 2012, and the company's stock trades in the $165 range on the NASDAQ market. Of the company's global employee roster of 5,950, approximately 1,050 work in RTP. A major player in guiding the $38 billion company is Michelle Sanders, who, as general manager of Biogen's Research Triangle Park operations, is the top company executive here. Even before she joined the Biogen team, Sanders gained an interest in MS via a college roommate who was diagnosed with the disease. "You can imagine having a best friend who is like a sister to you," she says, pausing. A phone call to that friend was the second one she made after accepting the job with Biogen. "I told her just to hang in there, and she can count on Biogen to continue to deliver the clinical programs. I'm in an industry that actually serves patients and is about making a difference to people and changing lives in a positive way that directly aligns with my values." An estimated 400,000 people have MS. As for McIntosh, she feels healthier than ever, and she looks forward to the day when MS won't stand for multiple sclerosis, but instead will stand for mystery solved. Part 2 of Biogen's Miracle Drug article is "The Company's RTP Facility is a Ground Zero for Medicines." This article is also by Lauren K. Onisores. It takes 50 days for biologic medications, Avonex and Tysabri, to make it to a syringe, says Biogen IDEC's Mike McBrady. "The manufacturing process is similar," he says, referring to both drugs, both manufactured in the RTP. Step 1. Thaw the cells. "With both drugs, we're starting with frozen engineered cells," he says. "In our case, we work with mammalian cells. Those cells are genetically engineered to secrete proteins, and those proteins are the active ingredient in the drugs. The thawing cells are fed media, a liquid solution to help them grow, a process that happens in tanks. As they grow, they're moved to a larger tank. Avonex ends up in a 2,000-liter tank, while Tysabri in a 15,000-liter tank. The cells are growing, multiplying and dividing, and at the end of the process, they are secreting the proteins," says McBrady, senior manager of public affairs for the company. "It's a process that takes about 40 days. Next comes purification, a process in which the liquid goes through a filtering system to harvest the protein. Then comes chromatography, in which resins are bound to the protein molecule and impurities are flushed out. We end up with what we call the bulk drug substance," he says, adding that it's divided into 2-liter bottles. "Currently, that's where the RTP process ends. The product is shipped to packaging facilities elsewhere, under a partnership with Eisai. However, some of the product can go to the Eisai facility in RTP to be filled. From thaw to fill, that will be about 50 or 60-odd days," says McBrady. Moving inside the front cover, "At last, foreclosures here are heading south." By Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. Figures compiled by the North Carolina court system indicate the home foreclosure problem is on the wane in the Triangle. Wake, Durham, and Orange counties combined posted 9 fewer foreclosure filings in 2012 compared with the prior year. The raw numbers were 6,338 cases in 2012 versus 6,347 in 2011. The figures represent civil court filings in each of the locations that dealt with a home or business foreclosure. Residential filings make up a large majority of the cases. The numbers are compiled by the North Carolina Administrative Office of the Courts, or AOC. Statewide for 2012, foreclosures were still rising, but only by a modest 2.8% to 54,745, some 1,510 more cases than in 2011. That's still a lot of people losing their homes, but even so, the 2012 total was down by 18% from North Carolina's peak foreclosure year of 2010, when the victims numbered 66,280. North Carolina State University economist Mike Walden, who follows the trend, believes the 2012 data, as well as other sets of numbers on improving sales and home prices, demonstrate that a corner has indeed been turned. I would agree with that statement, says Walden, but that means foreclosure is no longer a problem? No, but all the recent indicators point to an improvement in housing. Janicki Ratcliffe, executive director of the UNC Chapel Hill Center for Community Capital, assesses the situation in much the same way. It does seem like we have come off the bottom, she says, adding, however, that foreclosures remain elevated in a state with a persistently high unemployment rate. But we are not seeing an increase in inventories of foreclosed properties, and they are declining, says Ratcliffe. Of the three Triangle counties, only Wake experienced a small increase in foreclosures in 2012, up 62 cases from the prior year to 4,599. That total, however, was 17.8% below the Wake peak foreclosure year of 2010, when cases hit 5,595, according to the AOC data. Meanwhile, in Orange County, filings fell by 34 cases, or by 10.8%, in 2012 to 282. In Durham County, they fell by 37 filings, or 2.5%, to 1,457. Triangle mortgage lender Steve Thorne, who crafts loan packages on foreclosed real estate throughout the area, agrees that the market is on a bounce back that he dates to February 2012. He says the volume of deals he handles involving foreclosed real estate has dropped by an estimated 50% in recent months. After so many years of wreck and ruin, you would think that it's run its course, he says. But yes, I think the market has bounced back, and it's running along nicely. Next up, study passing on Medicaid to cost 25,000 jobs by Jason DeBruin from Raleigh. If North Carolina rejects an expansion of Medicaid benefits, as now seems all but certain, the state would not pick up an estimated 25,000 new jobs, not add $1.7 billion to the annual state domestic product, and not reap $70 million in additional annual state taxes, concludes a new study. Amherst, Massachusetts-based economic analyst and research group, REMI, Regional Economic Models Incorporated, projected the economic impact of a Medicaid expansion for the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. The analysis looked at years of 2014 through 2021. The total employment impact would spike at 25,684 additional jobs in 2016, and the state would gain $11 billion in domestic product in those 8 years, concludes the study. The benefit to the state would result in part because the federal government covers most of the cost of expanded coverage. In 2012, more than $14 billion was spent for Medicaid in North Carolina, but only $3 billion of that came from state funds. To serve as an incentive to expand Medicaid, the federal government offers to pay the full cost of any additional participants in the program for years 2014 through 2016, and step back down to 90% by 2020. The North Carolina Institute of Medicine incorporated some of Remy's reports in one of its own. Because of the high federal match rate, the offsets, and the new tax revenues, the state would likely experience a net savings of $65.4 million from the Medicaid expansion over the 8-year period, it concluded. If fully expanded, Americans making up to 138% of the federal poverty level, which is $15,000 for an individual or $31,000 for a family of four in 2012, and they would qualify for Medicaid. A report from the Kaiser Foundation and the Urban Institute estimates that in North Carolina, an additional 568,000 people would enroll in Medicaid by 2022. In that scenario, the state would spend $71 billion on the program between 2013 and 2022. Without Medicaid expansion, the group estimates spending of $66 billion during that time. Because of the incentive, federal costs in the state would hit $172 billion between 2013 and 2022, Kaiser estimates, or $45 billion more than if Medicaid is not expanded. Those additional costs seem to be the rub for Republicans in the General Assembly, who are leading a charge to block the expansion. The current Medicaid system in North Carolina is broken and not ready to expand without great risk to the taxpayers and to the delivery of existing services to those in need, says Governor Pat McCrory in a statement released February 12th. Shortly thereafter, Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest followed suit. When the feds pass a law that gives them regulatory control but passes all the administrative and operational expenses down to the state, our state should have the backbone to fight back. I applaud the governor for his thoughtful analysis of the situation and his resolve to do what is right for North Carolina. Other groups took the opposite tack. The AARP said rejecting Medicaid expansion would be a significant setback and pointed to several other states, even some led by Republicans, that are adopting the expansion. These moves will likely lead to more changes for the state, such as job losses in health care fields, higher insurance premiums, and more crowded emergency rooms, according to the AARP statement. The North Carolina Justice Center has pointed out that rejecting the expansion could hurt business owners who employ low-wage workers. Under the current system, North Carolina has relatively restrictive regulations for Medicaid enrollment, meaning that many don't qualify. Employers of workers who could have qualified for Medicaid under the expansion will be required to extend health insurance or face penalties. Those are penalties they could have avoided if the workers could have qualified for Medicaid, explains Adam Linker, a policy analyst for the Justice Center. Next up, son Adam Lofton spurs dad Jay to return to the concrete business with a new company. And this article is entitled Rock of Ages. It's by Amanda Jones Hoyle. When the Eagle Rock concrete trucks rolled out of a new concrete plant on Mount Hermon Road earlier this week, it was the start of a new beginning for Jay Lofton and his son Adam. Lofton, a veteran of the concrete industry who helped build the Ready Mix Concrete Company into one of the largest producers of concrete in the Southeast, was about ready to retire when Adam, fresh out of grad school, came to him with the idea to start another business. "I didn't have a plan to do this," says the elder Lofton. He had left his role as CEO of Raleigh-based Ready Mix Concrete in 2009 after the company was sold to a Colombian cement company in 2006 for $435 million. Adam Lofton, now 31, went to work full-time at Ready Mix after graduating from Duke University and left around the same time as his father in 2009 to pursue an MBA degree at NC State University. "I saw the value of being in business for myself, and I grew up in the shadow of all these guys," the younger Lofton says, referring to the group of investors backing Eagle Rock Concrete. The group includes such well-known businessmen as O. Temple Sloan, Jr., chairman of General Parts International, Raleigh real estate developer Ron Gibson, former Ready Mix co-owner George Turner, and Eagle Rock's Vice President of Finance, Henry Willey, who worked at Ready Mix for 22 years. "I wouldn't really call us a startup," Jay Lofton says. "It's more of a restart." The Loftons have spent the last year and a half putting together the business plan and acquiring the equipment for Eagle Rock Concrete. Jay Lofton wouldn't go into the details of how much Eagle Rock's investors have spent on the endeavor so far, but by all estimates, they've invested around $6 million. $200,000 for each of the 15 concrete trucks, $2 million towards the acquisition of land for a concrete plant in Raleigh, and a second plant in Apex, plus the site planning, permitting, and construction of the first concrete plant on Mount Hermon Road near Raleigh-Durham International Airport. The Loftons are negotiating to build a third plant in the Garner area. "When you start a concrete company, it's certainly an investment," says Tim Clancy, president of Clancy & Thays Construction Company in Raleigh. Clancy is not an investor for Eagle Rock, but he has worked with Lofton and with Eagle Rock's other owners on projects in the past. "There's a lot of competition now, but they have a leg up as all local guys. Everyone already respects them. We'll certainly give them a shot at it. But concrete production is a commodity business, and when all things are equal, contractors are going to choose the company with the lowest cost. In the Triangle, at least 9 concrete production companies collectively operate about 45 concrete plants, according to a review of the membership directory of Carolina's Ready Mix Concrete Association, a trade group that represents concrete production companies in North Carolina and South Carolina. Bill Arendt, Executive Vice President of CRMCA, says that while concrete price is important, it can often come in second to services such as on-time delivery, as well as the quality of the product. The lowest price isn't always the best price, he says, and I think there's always going to be room for independent producers in the market if you have the wherewithal to do it. Arendt also notes that concrete production in North Carolina has been cut in half from pre-recession levels. Adam Lofton, general manager of the new company, says that the partners are banking on the strategic location of the plants along the Interstate 540 corridor and their decades-long relationships with leaders in the Triangle's builder market. I don't think our competition can replicate our entire strategy, he says. We're investing heavily in our people and in our equipment. I think there is a need for small, locally owned concrete business, and we're going to strive to foster those relationships. Continuing on, bad data cited in rejection of bids from UNC and Johnston. By Jason DeBrune, from Raleigh. The NC Department of Health and Human Services rejected applications from UNC Healthcare and Johnston Health to add rehabilitation beds largely because the hospital systems based projections on unrealistic or unreliable data. On January 30th, DHHS awarded Duke Raleigh Hospital 12 rehabilitation beds and Wake Med Hospitals and Health 8 such beds. UNC Healthcare and Johnston Health also applied to add these beds but were denied by the state. According to DHHS, UNC Healthcare provided revenue projections based on unreliable information and failed to demonstrate the financial feasibility for the project. In Johnston Health case, DHHS ruled the hospital based utilization rates on unreasonable assumptions and also failed to demonstrate the financial feasibility of the project. The hospital systems have until the end of February to file appeals. Officials from UNC Healthcare and Johnston Health declined to comment, citing a potential appeal and the need to review the full findings. The supply of rehabilitation services are regulated by the state in order to not flood an area with these types of services. The intention is to keep prices down by matching supply and demand. Rehabilitation patients usually require longer hospital stays, sometimes up to 2 weeks, typically to recover from serious illnesses or injuries that could require the patient to relearn basic functions. At Wake Med, the additional beds add up to one of the largest rehabilitation hospitals in the Southeast. It currently operates an 84-bed unit and has already been approved to add 14 more beds. The 8 additional beds will bring the unit to 106 beds. Almost as importantly, Wake Med will transition from shared rooms to private rooms. This is actually an area of rehabilitation care that has changed, explains Stan Taylor, Wake Med's Vice President for Corporate Planning, and Elaine Rolick, Wake Med Executive Director of Rehab and Trauma Services. Over the past few decades, shared rooms were the norm. That's changed, and there is more an emphasis on privacy. In fact, having semi-private rooms is the biggest complaint Rolick receives from patients and their families. Pending appeals, Wake Med proposes to build a new rehab tower with 49 private rooms at a cost of $25 million. The beds approved for Duke Raleigh would represent an entirely new unit with a capital investment of $4.2 million. The hospital projects generating $1.4 million in net income on $4.6 million of patient revenue in the first operating year, and increasing that to $2.1 million of net income on $5.7 million of patient revenue by the third fiscal year, which would end June 30th, 2017. From the real estate column, Wick is saving $5 million on a remake. This article is by Amanda Jones Hoyle. A $19.1 million redevelopment of the former Coca-Cola warehouse and distribution building in South Raleigh should begin soon, transforming it into a vocational and technical school for high school and community college students to open in the fall of 2014 semester. But the deal didn't come easily, as the developer, who had an option to buy the property, tangled with Wake County government leaders who didn't want to lease the building from the developer. Keystone Corporation of Raleigh in the fall of 2012 proposed a public-private partnership in which Keystone would purchase and renovate the old Coca-Cola property on behalf of the county and lease the renovated building to the Wake County Public School System. After a minimum 5-year lease term, the county would have the option to purchase the building. The estimated cost of the deal was around $28 million. But the county decided to buy it and paid a little more than $3 million for the 15 acres and the building. Keystone will be paid $1 million for its efforts. Wake County Manager David Cook estimates the county will spend a total of $23 million on the project, including the cost of the furniture and fixtures for the classroom. That, he says, will save the county $5 million. We couldn't come to terms on the finances, Cook says, regarding the abandoned public-private partnership. Also, new Harris Teeter is slated for North Raleigh. The Harris Teeter grocery chain will be building a new store location at the intersection of Creedmoor Road and Millbrook Road in North Raleigh after recently signing a lease at the site. York Development Group of Charlotte has owned the 7-acre wooded lot at the southeast quadrant of the intersection since 2006, and the property was rezoned in August to allow for development of a shopping center. York Development Group owner Doug Bumgardner did not return calls for comment. Harris Teeter plans to open 3 stores in the Triangle in 2013, at Creedmoor Commons at NC 98 and Old Creedmoor Road, a second at Flowers Crossroads in Clayton, and a third at 9th Street and Hillsborough Road in Durham. Chris Bagley writes to us about solar financing and how the models have shifted. The rapid growth in North Carolina's solar energy industry has prompted big changes in how projects are planned and financed, a shift underscored by a move by Progress Energy Carolinas in January to curtail a key incentive for solar developers. Developers reacted with disappointment, mid-sized developers in particular, but several also said the incentives are no longer as important as they once were, thanks to the new financing arrangement in the private sector. Developers also noted that Progress's move follows dramatically reduced costs in the solar industry, particularly for solar panels and other hardware. The utility is seeking regulatory approval to cut an initial participation payment for homeowners who install solar panels as part of its SunSense residential program. Separately, Progress elected this year not to renew its commercial SunSense program, which had paid guaranteed prices for electricity generated by panels atop industrial and office buildings. It does change the financials, says Maria Kingergi, who owns Southern Energy Management. She co-owns Southern Energy Management, a Morrisville-based solar installer and consulting firm that specializes in residential and small commercial buildings. However, there are more leasing options, for example, and more ways to finance projects. NC Solar Center Executive Director Steve Kaland notes that leasing can still be trickier than in some other states. While a homeowner or building owner can own a rooftop solar array and use its power, a third party is not allowed to own the array and sell it to the resident or building owner in North Carolina. Only municipal utilities, co-ops, and investor-owned companies like Progress and sister utility Duke Energy Carolinas are allowed to sell power directly to users. Still, Kingery and others in the solar industry say they'll continue to benefit from the state and national tax credits that are available to the owners of solar generating projects. Argand Energy Solutions, another moderately large developer that focuses heavily on small commercial buildings used to rely on customers who plan to use the SunSense program. But CEO Eric Lynch says the company, which has offices in Durham and Charlotte, has tweaked its business model since June, when Progress first suspended the program. The company has gone more aggressively after different customers and new financing arrangements, says Lynch. And now from the technology column, Lauren K. on Esaurus. Painting to get vessels is shipshape. Imagine a ship with skin that can twitch. When a bug lands on your arms during a summer picnic, you can twitch it away, right? Ships, inanimate as they are, don't have that luxury when attacked by the likes of barnacles and zebra mussels. They have to sit there and take it, even as the organisms build up on the hull. People spend hundreds of dollars and pay professional divers to go under and clean their boats, says Danny Neal, dockmaster at Joyner Marina in Carolina Beach. To never have barnacles, it would not be possible without pulling your old boat completely out of the water. Maybe not forever. A polymer being developed by Duke University researchers could let ships and other vessels do what they've never been able to do before. Twitch, and in doing so, barnacles and the bacteria that attracts them would fall off instantly. The polymer could be used as paint, says Duke engineer Zanhi Zaru. The key is creating enough surface tension to get the materials, such as barnacles, to debond from the substrate, the polymer. As part of its work in creating the polymer, Duke researchers first used electric voltage and other methods, such as stretching pressure and blowing air, were found to be effective as triggers to create wrinkles in the paint. Those wrinkles were all it took, says researcher Daniel Richoff of the Duke University Marine Lab in Beaufort. They popped right off, he says, of the barnacles he supplied. Zhou says the deformations in the material happen at the microscopic level and don't change the aesthetics of the polymer. And the process can be repeated if scum attacks again. After we got this general understanding, we began to apply it to other mechanisms, Zhao explains. Barnacles are created when a bacteria settles on a ship, resulting in a scummy surface called biofilm, the food for the barnacles. If the polymer could reject sea scum bacteria, why couldn't it also be used to protect medical implants from disease-causing bacteria? No reason, says Gabriel Lopez, Duke engineer and director of the National Science Foundation-funded Research Triangle Materials Research Science and Engineering Center. Lopez, who has been studying bacterial biofilms for at least 15 years and helped Zoe apply his materials research to bacteria, says among the many private companies interested in the technology are medical device firms. Infection is a big problem with materials that are implanted in medical situations, he says, adding that urinary catheters could be particularly improved by the technology. In the short term, it's unlikely the technology will paint a ship, at least not a seagoing Navy vessel, anytime soon, as triggering an entire hull's polymer might be complicated. Ocean sensor devices are better use for the polymer for now, but it's possible in the future. And now a spotlight on manufacturing by Jason DeBrun. This forum focuses on education and work. Leaders of higher education and executives in private industry say they want more collaboration across their borders and that colleges and universities need to graduate students who are ready to step into a highly specialized workforce. At the annual Emerging Issues Forum hosted by NC State University's Institute for Emerging Issues on February 11th and 12th, a solid chunk of time was devoted to what role North Carolina's educational institutions should play in conjunction with private industry. While the overall unemployment rate has stayed stubbornly high, employers look for technically skilled workers and say they find it difficult to recruit good talent. That's a problem as the current labor force ages and nears retirement without a crop of new workers to fill those shoes. I cannot find enough people to fill those jobs fast enough, says Omo Blondie, the plant manager for a Siemens Energy Service Center in Winston-Salem. The plant has been in operation for 40 years, and Blondie says a big portion of the workforce has been there for nearly that long. In fact, nearly 30% of the workers are at or nearing retirement age, he says. Michelle Sanders, Vice President of Manufacturing and the General Manager of Biogen's IDEX Triangle Operations and moderator of the panel, agreed, saying her company faces the same problems. The forum this year focused heavily on manufacturing and what the state needs to do to become a manufacturing leader, as it was when textiles, tobacco, and furniture were anchors of the state's economy. Those jobs are changing, says Bondi, and the new skills are required. That's where colleges and universities come in, forming partnerships with private industry. Gary Green, president of Forsyth Technical Community College, talked about a partnership formed with Siemens that actually puts Siemens equipment in Forsyth Tech's classrooms so graduates can move seamlessly into the factory. I cannot operate without the community colleges, Bondi says. Scott Rawls, president of the community college system, says those partnerships are good, but that colleges and universities still need to teach students how to think, not just how to operate a specific machine. We tend to think either or, Rawls says. We've got to break out of that paradigm. Continuing on about manufacturing, a particular group wants North Carolina tax credits to spur manufacturing. And a new statewide study suggests new state tax credits for North Carolina manufacturers that make investments in emerging industries. The North Carolina Rural Economic Development Center study also says that NC Manufacturing Council should be formed by May to serve as an advocate for manufacturing with the governor, the state legislature, and others. The state's business and political leaders must work together to ensure that we have in place the programs and policies that will strengthen this important sector, says Billy Ray Hall, president of the Rural Center. The study says jobs should be the priority among North Carolina manufacturers since the average rural manufacturing wage is $42,297 per year, nearly one-third higher than the pay in non-manufacturing jobs. The study, titled Our Manufacturing Future, Toward a More Prosperous Rural North Carolina, notes that in 2011, North Carolina's manufacturing sector saw its first annual increase in jobs in 16 years. According to the study, manufacturing represents 20% of the state's GDP. Its companies purchase significant inputs from many other sectors, including research and development, professional services, agriculture, travel, construction, and trucking. Because manufacturing is a large exporter, much of this activity results from new money being brought into North Carolina's economy. This report clearly shows that manufacturing can remain a vital economic engine for North Carolina's long-term future, says Hall. Nationally, manufacturing accounted for 8.9% of total employment in 2012. In North Carolina, the share was 10.9% of total employment, and in North Carolina's 85 rural counties, the share was greater at 14.4%. In the Research Triangle region's rural counties, the study says, the plastics, meat processing, and packaged foods are our largest at-risk sectors. Collectively, these three sectors employ more than 5,500 workers. The Rural Center is planning a second report, which will contain other recommendations to be released next month. And now a small business profile, McThriff Office Furniture. This article is by Dale Gibson. Who would throw away a brand well-known in the state of North Carolina? Ed Boer, that's who. In 1982, two gentlemen named Bill Crawley and Frank Biggerstaff launched an office furniture company in Raleigh and branded it so that the very name would convey inexpensive. Soon that name, McThriff Office Furniture, will exist no more. And that's Ed Boer's decision. Boer, a veteran of the office furnishings industry, acquired McThriff in December through a leveraged purchase. The ink was barely dry on the closing papers when he walked into the McThriff offices on Capitol Boulevard to introduce himself as the new owner. It was a bit of a shock for the employees, he laughs. Boer's now working on plans for repositioning the company. He's contracted with an advertising agency to come up with a new name, not chosen yet, but it will probably be along the lines of Space Matters, not Boer Interiors, that will position the company to compete head-to-head with the likes of Alfred Williams & Company and Store Office Environments. Desk and chairs, Boer's knows from experience, can be bought in all price ranges from a variety of sellers. He doesn't want to compete at that level. He wants to appeal to company owners and their designers and architects who are looking for complete space solutions, not just furniture. He'll also have his own in-house design staff. He knows he's throwing away a lot of brand recognition by ditching the McThrift name, but he has no hesitation in doing so. It is well known, but it doesn't fit where I want to go. The original owners of McThrift sold the company in 2007 to Allsteel, an office furniture manufacturer that is represented in the market by McThrift. The Raleigh company was wobbling through the recession, and Allsteel, which itself has improved the quality of its goods, its brand, and image over the years, couldn't fathom not having a dealer in the Triangle. But Allsteel otherwise had no interest in owning the dealership, so when Boer came along with an offer, the sale was consummated. What Boer bought was a company with four offices in North Carolina that serve all 100 counties, 43 employees, and an income statement that shows $17.5 million in revenue in 2012. Besides the name and image change, the company will soon move from Capitol Boulevard to the renovated Pilot Mill Building near the Mordecai neighborhood in downtown Raleigh. Granted, it's a building that's off of the beaten path, but that doesn't matter. What Boer wants is a showroom that offers an experience to clients, not to window shoppers. One Boer customer who will be looking is Joe Spina, facilities manager for Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina. Spina says Boer has done an excellent job of helping Blue Cross Blue Shield standardize its furniture over the past 12 years and in the process saved the company some 100,000 square feet of space. "We're standardized on Herman Miller," says Spina of the furniture brand represented by Boer at Alfred Williams and Company. But he says, "I'm willing to listen to what he has to offer with his new company." Boer began working in the office furnishings industry at the age of 19 when he took a summer job with Herman Miller at his home state in New Jersey. The chemistry clicked between the company and Boer, leading to a four-year education paid by Herman Miller. He worked at various locations for the Michigan company, ending up with a job in Sanford. He liked the South, decided to stay here, and in 1996 joined Alfred Williams and Company in Raleigh as a chief operating officer. Last spring, though, it became clear to Boer that "I wanted to do more at the same time than the company owner, Blount Williams, wanted to do more." They agreed to terms and Boer left. It took a few months to nail down the McThrift purchase. Going forward, the new owner is convinced the rebranded McThrift not only can survive, but can thrive. "The company is underperforming in a number of markets," he says, adding, "I believe we can double revenue within 5 years." This week's guest opinion is Mr. Seth Becker. Mr. Becker is a financial planner in Gahanna, Ohio, and his article is entitled, "Are We Risking Deeper Inequity?" As budget talks go in Washington, D.C., we again faced a standoff over raising revenue and cutting spending to get the national deficit under control. When it comes to Social Security and Medicare, much of the discussion has been aimed at raising the age of eligibility to keep the programs in fiscal health. But almost unmentioned, hiding in the background, is the assumption that raising the eligibility age for those who will participate in those two programs affects everyone equally, since we are told that life expectancy in the U.S. is increasing. But is life expectancy increasing for every American, or will some groups be hurt by a hike in the age of eligibility? In a paper titled "Differences in Life Expectancy Due to Race and Educational Differences Are Widening and May Not Catch Up," by a group that included social scientist Jay Olshansky, a professor from the School of Public Health at the University of Chicago, this question is examined in detail. As you might expect, the study found the better educated and wealthier an individual, the longer they can expect to live. This trend is most pronounced among whites and is especially in line for those who have finished college and continued their higher education by age 25. Perhaps most surprising was that the life expectancy for white males who never completed high school has declined, startling considering the general rise in life expectancy in our nation. What does this have to do with the budget battle? Plenty. Consider that if life expectancy increases with higher levels of education and income, then raising the eligibility age for government programs means more members of that group would qualify for benefits for a longer period of time. but have Medicare and Social Security taxes for the less educated declined because they aren't expected to live as long and thus won't benefit as much? No. As a result, raising eligibility age would take benefits and money from those least able to afford it and transfer the benefits to wealthier people. That means raising the eligibility age is not a step that would uniformly affect Americans. With conscious thought, we are proposing solutions that will take away resources from those least able to afford the loss and transfer them to those who likely will use them for a longer period. If we believe taxes are too high and spending is too great, we cannot hope to fix this inequity by raising taxes and taking away services from those who can least afford it, creating yet a more troubling injustice. This would only result in more people using Medicaid and other government services. This week's guest column is by Mr. Kent Hoover. Mr. Hoover, a Duke University grad, runs the Washington Bureau for the Triangle Business Journal. His column is entitled, "Where Was Small Business in Obama's Plan?" President Barack Obama used his State of the Union speech to highlight the need to reignite the true engine of America's economic growth, a rising, thriving middle class. But some business leaders who watched the speech were struck that Obama didn't talk much about one of the best ways to grow middle-class jobs, creating an environment in which small businesses thrive. Obama's speech probably had the fewest specific mentions of small businesses of any recent State of the Union address, says Todd McCracken, president and CEO of the National Small Business Association. The president did talk about small businesses in the context of tax reform and in a way that McCracken said hit the biggest tax problem facing small business owners, the tax code's complexity. The American people deserve a tax code that helps small businesses spend less time filling out complicated forms and more time expanding and hiring, Obama said. The president, however, didn't talk about access to capital, which remains a problem for many small businesses. Obama did talk about reaching a long-term deficit reduction deal, but that was vague about how to get there. Uncertainty over the government's fiscal future is holding small businesses back, says NSB Chairman David Eichert, Vice President of Finance for Air Tractor Incorporated in Olney, Texas. We need a big budget deal. We need to quit lurching from crisis to crisis, he says. The president did talk about other issues that are important to businesses of all size, such as immigration reform, international trade, and the above all, energy policy. He talked about all of these before. It wouldn't be a State of the Union address, however, if the president didn't offer some new proposals. For example, the president proposed raising the federal minimum wage to $9 an hour by 2015. This single step would raise the incomes of millions of working families, Obama said. Businesses would get customers with more money in their pocket, he says. But Karen Karajan, president and CEO of the Small Business and Entrepreneurship Council, thinks the minimum wage is counterproductive because it would destroy entry-level jobs. McCracken said a minimum wage increase would affect different types of businesses differently, but it certainly isn't something that helps small businesses grow and add jobs. David Koch, who owns a Culver's franchise in Rockford, Illinois, as well as an engineering firm, said he's not that concerned about a minimum wage increase as long as there are exceptions for inexperienced workers, such as high school students. Some of Obama's other new proposals were more creative, such as spending $1 billion on 15 manufacturing innovation institutes around the country as part of his goal to making America a magnet for new jobs in manufacturing. The president also wants to establish a new energy security trust, which would use revenue generated by oil and natural gas development on federal lands and offshore to fund research that would allow us to stop using gasoline and diesel fuels for our vehicles. Obama also proposed spending $50 billion on the nation's infrastructure needs and $15 billion on a new project rebuild program, which would put people to work rehabilitating and demolishing vacant buildings in the depressed areas of the country. The president said we could spend money on all these things without increasing our deficit by a single dime. It's not a bigger government we need, but a smarter government that sets priorities and invests in broad-based growth, he said. What programs would be cast aside in order to pay for these new programs? Obama must be saving that for another speech. Folks around the world are gobbling up gobblers. Between 2009 and 2011, the volume of turkeys exported from North Carolina doubled. It should come to no surprise that Butterball, a turkey production company based in Garner, played a major role in that export growth. Butterball exports more than 100 million pounds of turkeys to more than 50 countries annually, which represents about 15% of its annual volume. In honor of that success, North Carolina Agricultural Commissioner Steve Troxler and the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services recognized Butterball with its 2013 North Carolina Exporter of the Year Award at a ceremony in late January. And Michael Dorman of Fuquay Varina has received the Presidential Citizens Medal, the second highest civilian honor award by the nation's president and commander-in-chief. Dorman is founder and executive director of Military Missions in Action, which helps veterans with disabilities live independently. The organization is based in Fuquay Varina. Those folks at the Blow Hair Salon were on their feet for 24 hours straight, cutting hair in an annual fundraiser that this year benefits the Alliance Medical Ministry. Julie Eakins of the ministry tells the Triangle Business Journal, it was the most successful cut-a-thon yet, raising more than $15,000. Way to blow, go. And the biotechnology industry is soaring. That's according to Research-Driven Investing, which looks at indices, including the iShares NASDAQ Biotechnology Index, that have all gained more than 20% in the past year. Add in the 15-year high being experienced in FDA approvals, 39 last year, a 30% increase, and RDI calls it a bull market for the biotechnology industry in 2012. The folks at Chrysler will be giving attendees the opportunity to test drive various models at the 2013 North Carolina International Auto Expo at the State Fairgrounds in Raleigh through February 17th. Attendees can also register for a chance to win $45,000 toward the purchase of a new Chrysler vehicle. Some of the vehicles available will be the Chrysler 200S convertible, Dodge Challenger SRT and Charger, along with the cute little Fiat 500. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and this program will be available online at TriangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.